بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، والصلاة والسلام على أفضل المرسلين سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. Ladies and gentlemen, I will preface my remarks about a short story of education. When my late father was thinking of sending his children to school abroad, his first destination for us was going to be the American University of Beirut. Then he had the wisdom, as he always did, to consult with others and asked a very good Lebanese friend of his whether that is a good idea or not. And you must remember this was in the 50s. And his Lebanese friend turned to him and he said, if you want your children to become socialists and Baathists, send them to the American University of Beirut. Hence, we all came to the United States. I thank Admiral Berenson and Dr. John Duke Anthony for inviting me to speak at this august gathering. It's nice to be back at the Arab American Council. I also thank Ambassadors Cutler, Fowler, and Fraker, and Jordan for what they said about me yesterday. Frankly, I couldn't get out of the room here because my head was so big. But in all humility, it was nice to hear the accolades. I also want to thank Ambassador Fraker especially for taking the time to visit more places in the kingdom than I have, and to make the connection with the Saudi people that he has. It is vitally important to do that, not only to show the flag, as it were, but to deny our enemies their aim of separating us from each other. And despite the title of this panel, and with Dr. Anthony's and Marwan's indulgence, or as in this case, without it, I shall address my remarks to quotations from statements I heard during the last 3 months. And if Dr. Anthony and Marwan would indulge me, and I shall hear and obey, I shall refer to some of what I heard yesterday in the truly inspiring panels on Iraq and Iran, and the other panels, and the other equally inspiring panels of today. Last September, ladies and gentlemen, at the Republican Party's National Convention, the former Secretary of State, Dr. Henry Kissinger, in replying to a question about the United States' relationship with the kingdom and the effect of oil on it, had this to say: "It is an issue that has defeated every administration that I have observed. I think everybody, if they were given truth serum, would recognize that this is an unviable system, and nobody has been willing to face the consequences of overthrowing the system." And what does Mr. Kissinger propose to remove the constraint to overthrowing Saudi Arabia? He proposes the following: "Of course, we ought to reduce our dependence on oil, and we know how to do it on two levels." He then describes how alternatives can be used, and he also describes how it was possible in the 70s to organize the consumers to act collectively in the face of what he calls a monopoly. He finishes by saying, "And could you do the consumer group, then the relative position of the oil producers would rapidly decline, and then the issue of political evolution would be less fraught if it didn't matter so much whether there was a period of uncertainty in Saudi Arabia. You could tackle the problem in a different way than you can under present circumstances." This, ladies and gentlemen, is from one who is considered the elder statesman of America. Not a very statesman-like statement. Is Dr. Kissinger calling for the overthrow of the kingdom? And for what? The next president and administration should discard such jingoistic propositions. America should resist the call made by many influential people and organizations to regard the issue of energy in them and us terms. There can never be energy independence because oil is a fungible commodity, bought and sold in many cases and instances while the tankers are out at sea. It will also remain the cheapest source of energy for the foreseeable future. So instead of calling for energy independence, the United States should pick up the hand that King Abdullah has offered and join in a collective effort to meet this grave challenge. The United States should also stop deluding itself, if that is what Mr. Kissinger was deluding himself with, that Saudi Arabia can be overthrown. When Mr. Kissinger is supposed to have threatened the late King Faisal with the prospect of no more customers for Saudi oil, the King is supposed to have said that we will go back to our tents in the desert and live on camel's milk and dates. But you, Mr. Kissinger, what will you do if there is no oil? This is probably an apocryphal account. This is probably an apocryphal account, but it is indicative of the kingdom's resolve to survive, regardless of what Mr. Kissinger believes or advocates. I'll now refer to a speech that Under Secretary of State for Public Diplomacy, Glassman, gave at the Foreign Press Center briefing on July 15, 2008. In this briefing, Secretary Glassman said, and I quote, "The key goals today are to diminish the threat to America and the rest of the world posed by violent extremism and weapons of mass destruction, and to help people around the world to achieve freedom. Now those two goals are linked. As the National Security Strategy puts it, championing freedom advances our interest because of the survival of liberty at home increasingly depends on the success of liberty abroad." How true, Mr. Glassman. How about living up to those words and championing the freedom for Palestinians? The Secretary goes on to say the following. "In the war of ideas, our core task is not to fix foreigners' perceptions of the United States. Those perceptions are important, but America's image, indeed America itself, is not at the center of the war of ideas." How extraordinary. He goes on to say, "The shorthand of this policy is diversion, powerful and lasting diversion, the channeling of potential recruits away from violence with the attractions of entertainment, culture, literature, music, technology, sports, education, business, in addition to politics and religion." Further on, he says, "There is a widespread belief in Muslim nations, about 4 out of 5 people believe this, that the United States and other Western powers are out to destroy Islam and replace it with Christianity. It's a widespread belief, and this is the root belief that underlies much of the passive support for the violent extremism of Al-Qaeda and similar groups. The flow of new recruits has not stopped." End of quote. I don't see how he squares this statement with his previous one. Can you? How can you admit that the root cause that brings in recruits to Al-Qaeda is the view of America as a destroyer of Islam, and say at the same time that America's image is not at the center of the war of ideas? I cannot understand this doublespeak. In answering a question afterwards about how important is it to capture Osama bin Laden to win this war of ideas, the Secretary answers, "I don't think it's particularly important. And whether Osama bin Laden is killed or captured, I think is not of great consequence." I remember hearing President Bush saying we will get Bin Laden. Every day that Bin Laden lives after the president's promise gathers him more prestige and an aura of invincibility. His image as the untouchable scourge of the greatest power on earth is the best recruiting means for him. His cult enhances itself and presents itself as the champion of Muslims, whom the secretary readily admits are convinced that the United States is out to destroy them. Again, I cannot understand the doublespeak. Finally, in answering the following question, the Jerigian report, among its other conclusions, concluded that no matter how good your public diplomacy is, it's ultimately policy that makes the difference, and that you can only improve what you are trying, or you only achieve what you are trying to achieve to a certain degree without addressing policy issues. The secretary, who was a member of the Jerigian Commission, gives a long and rambling answer. He parries the question, but does not answer it. And I quote the following from his answer. First of all, the Jerigian report did talk about how important policy is. It made no judgment about whether policy is 80% or 90%, or certainly not 100%. You know how big a portion policy is as far as determining whether people trust or respect a nation. But it's important. There is no doubt about that. And I cited it myself as far as favorability and the United States is concerned. Now, in the end, policy is formulated for many reasons. I would be myself very much opposed to a policy that's formulated only because of public opinion in the world. I mean, that may be a factor, but it can't be the deciding factor. Can you understand that? I certainly can't. How about a policy that addresses what the secretary admits is a view among 80% of Muslims that America is out to destroy them? Ladies and gentlemen, America will get nowhere in the Arab and Muslim worlds until it radically changes its policy by implementing it rather than simply stating it. President Bush has stated that he wants a contiguous, viable, democratic Palestinian state living side by side with Israel. Do that. There is no need for further plans or initiatives or policies. They have all been addressed, dissected, and disseminated. All they need is implementation. I hope the next president does that. Now I shall address the other issues raised by the panels. On nuclear proliferation, the double standard is very much a factor in this issue. It was stated yesterday that Iran has opposed every American effort in the area and therefore should not be treated like others. Regardless of that, the reality is that the Iranian government's policy on nuclear enrichment is supported by the vast majority of the Iranian people. You have to address that public opinion by proposing as a first step to make the Middle East area free of nuclear and mass destruction weapons. This, ladies and gentlemen, does not reward a foe. Rather, it makes the foe unable to use the double standard to get support from its people. It also helps us, the friends of the United States, to point to the fairness of its position. On Palestine, it is equally important to remember that double standard holds there as well. The freely elected government of Palestine was summarily ostracized by the United States and Europe once it was elected, by people who take every opportunity to lecture us about espousing democratic practices. America even waged war to impose democracy on Iraq. How does that make sense? For the sake of America's friends in the area, including Israel. Instead of wearing kids' gloves when dealing with the Israelis, you should be wearing boxing gloves. And on Lebanon, get Israel out of Shab'a Farms and the other territories yesterday, not tomorrow. A final point that I would like to make to the next president, whoever he is. Pack your bags as soon as you're elected and go to the Middle East and listen and ponder what you hear before political dues and your advisors overtake you. Thank you very much.